Production. Recorded live.
Always record, episode 42.
What? Wait, what? I think you're on the wrong show, Alan.
I can't help it.
Hi, everyone. This is Doug. And today, on our 42 minutes, I'm joined by Alan Green, Alan Abadesa Green, and Bill Klaus from Always Record, a show in the ThinkBook Radio Network. And I have no idea what we're going to talk today, but I think Alan, he's reading this.
We have started our day talking about coffee and bad food and whose coffee is good or not. And I think these are, like, this is honestly, it's the weirdest things that these were the things that I wanted to actually bring up today. So before we do that, we have Bill Klaus on the line, is joining us today. So I know he has a sort of thing he wants to throw out, and I think it's going to fit in very nicely with the rest of the stuff. So sort of pass this along to Bill.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me again, Doug. Thanks for providing, 42 minutes for everyone out there. I've been writing about the Rubik's Cube over at my blogspot, ayahuasca.blogspot.com. It's a simple little toy everyone pretty much knows, pretty ubiquitous. Everyone's seen one. Everyone's messed around with one. But you know, it's one of those enigmas in my life that I've always meant to figure out how to solve. But the keys to get into how to solving it, it just eluded me. And I never really understood that there were directions that came with the damn thing. But I've just sort of, with all my time I've been spending with Finnegan's Wake, I've been kind of noticing that the two are kind of interrelated in that Joyce started with a very simple story, but then by manipulating it, he pretty much created this cube of language that seemingly is inaccessible to the average person. Just like trying to solve a Rubik's Cube is pretty goddamn impossible for the average person. But if you follow the directions, both with, you know, with the Rubik's Cube and following the directions and how to get back to square one, much like cheating with Finnegan's Wake, which is reading commentaries, reading other people's theories, if you spend enough time with it, you're kind of able to break through and kind of cut through the leaves of the jungle and kind of have some foundation. So I just was kind of throwing it out there for anyone to go out and buy one of these things and see if they can actually do it. Because even though you're given directions, it's kind of a complex process to actually even just following the directions. So I'm kind of curious to see what other people think, what their experience is with this. I don't know. Alan, Doug, have you ever had any experience with this little toy they call the Rubik's Cube?
Played with one, you know, years ago for brief intervals of time and thought it was, how is this supposed to work? But not in years, not at it for any length of time. I think you're finding something, what it seems to me is that you're finding something similar to what I found a few years ago with the idea, this sudden fascination with puzzles after doing all the sort of, you know, weird research we do and just, you know, playing with all these sort of mind games that we do. I had a fascination with literal puzzles, you know, jigsaw puzzles and things like that. And what I started doing, it was more conceptual than anything, but something I started doing was actually taking jigsaw puzzles and then arranging them in ways that they're not supposed to be arranged, to turn them to something else. Like I got a jigsaw puzzle of an elephant in the jungle, and I arranged it in such a way so that instead it was the pieces with the elephant skin on them I made into tree trunks and branches, and the sort of grasslands around the elephant I made into the leaves of the tree and stuff like that. And I made this other sort of collage out of it. And for me, it was this idea of there's the one way to solve a puzzle, and then there's the sort of step of, okay, fuck it, what else can we do with this?
Absolutely. I agree completely, because I think that with something like the Rubik's Cube, learning how to navigate the six different sides of the cube to get back to square one is just basically that's step one of that puzzle has to offer. Because then after you know from whatever position you get into, you can go back to home. Now you can start to develop quickness, and then you can start to develop devising specific patterns. But really is what you're doing is working in the pathways of your mind. You know, it's just another bridge. It's just another tool for sort of developing, I think it's perception more than anything, because it transforms itself from an impossibility into a puzzle, into a formula, and then into art. And then from art, you can pretty much amaze and astound people who are still living in the impossibility range. And it's through transforming, going through those stages, that's sort of what a magician is all about. It's presenting something to people in a magical way, but then giving them the keys to do it themselves. I'm kind of astounded that this Rubik's Cube has sort of gone under the radar for so many years, because it's just blatant. I mean, even in the symbolism of it, it's just a blatantly perfect distillation of this sort of alchemical process, and that the different stages that your brain has with the cube.
It's interesting to me. So I was the type of child that liked puzzles, but then when I realized how difficult the puzzle was, it was easy for me to give it up. And so, you know, the challenge at first is to work in one plane and solve one color, one side. But my question is, do you think, having not read the instructions, you could have figured out the algorithm yourself and then solved the cube?
Well, what I think, which is interesting about it, is that I don't think, unless I made that the central goal, like the central focus of everything that I studied, possibly over, and I would have to say in years it would take to find the solution and to sort of hold the solution, to be able to, like, you could get there, but did you know how you get there? There would have to be so much documentation, and every step would have to be recorded. And you would have to be able to go back and visualize the cube in your head with each step. Now, I'll grant you, to me, this is the goal of all education, is to sort of, in the athletics of the brain, it's to be able to fine-tune a person's brain to be able to think in this manner. But luckily, I think most of what we do with the advanced arts that we learn in school is that we work backwards, or at least those of us who are inclined to the mystery of life, is that we have these, the reverse engineering that they always posit about Area 51. We are a population of reverse engineering. You know, we didn't create language. We were born and it was grafted into us. We were born with computers. We were born with all this advanced stuff. And I think simpler people can just march forward with it attached to them as just something that makes life easier. But anyone who has any interest into the dynamics of life, they start to take it all apart and see how it works. And in that process, I think you wind up in these areas of conversation that I think that we seem to be spending a lot of time with. is that we have taken a lot of this stuff apart, and now we're in the process of putting it back together, but we're just sort of, you know, looking for other people who have found the same components and seeing where they're taking it and seeing, you know, because there's no instruction booklet. All these conversations are basically creating an instruction booklet. And it's rather fascinating that something that holds this entire process was introduced into America as a plastic toy in 1980. It's incredible.
Well, I love that you started with the Rubik's Cube and James Joyce, and in your mind you are comparing the processes similarly, because I spent a lot of time with Joseph Campbell, you know, as kind of like my doorway into the mysteries. Joseph Campbell's doorway into the mysteries, for all intents and purposes, was Joyce. And so, you know, his adventure begins in a bookshop with Finnegan's Wake, and, you know, he's yelling at the proprietor, how do you read this thing? What do you even do with this? And then that puzzle is what launched him into his whole study of mythology, where he realized that it's all there. The whole universe is in Finnegan's Wake. And so it was enough to launch him into his whole entire career of comparative mythological study. But it's interesting, thing that you say about, you know, it would have taken you a lifetime, you know, of recording every move to try and figure out how to solve it, that I think of Joseph Campbell's quote, you know, we have not even to risk the adventure alone, for the heroes of all time have gone before us. The labyrinth is thoroughly known. And when I started into Finnegan's Wake, I wanted an instruction booklet to try and understand what's happening as I was trying to move through this foreign and alien thing. And Joseph Campbell actually wrote a skeleton key to Finnegan's Wake. It was one of the first things that he did. And then he did The Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Now, can I just sort of bring something in here? Bill made the excellent point that all of this is found, at least for modern Western mind, is found in a little plastic toy. This idea that, you know, here we are, we're trying to find the entire universe and mysteries of the universe we expected in sort of highbrow classic art. And then what a lot of think research has shown us is that same, you know, you don't have to read Finnegan's Wake, you don't have to read, I mean, not saying you shouldn't, I'm just saying you could watch a Rihanna pop video and find the entire universe in this piece of plastic garbage. As much as we may or may not find that distasteful on a certain level, the plastic toy holds just as much mystery as, you know, the, you know, finest crafted puzzle box from, you know, 8th century BC, or, you know, some shit like that. That's I think, is what ultimately is part of the puzzle, is like trying to figure out, wait a second, how is there just as much mystery in this? And I think where I sort of was wanting to take this, and I think what makes this such an interesting overlap, is there's been conversation on both Always Record and 42 Minutes lately, this idea of, you know, the Valis loop, the cosmic cube, which, of course, the Rubik's Cube is very much the cosmic cube. It's, you know, it is the box, it's Pandora's box. It holds all the mysteries. But having the three of us together today, I thought was interesting, because I know, even though we're all in this community where everyone seems to have found a sort of pleasure with, hey, I can find in the pop plastic, I can find the mysteries of the universe. That must mean that everything is great. Everything is okay. Even the plastic is wonderful and divine. Everything must be great. And yet, I know I've spoken to Bill about, you know, that most people are eating a diet made of poison. I've spoken to Doug about, you know, this same idea, this idea of, you know, we're worshiping plastic over nature. I, of course, have a million things that bother me. I'm a cranky bastard. But the thing is that I thought having the three of us, where we're able to see on one level the sort of divine perfection and everything, and at the same time say, wait a second, there's still this glaring flaw. There's still issues that need to be resolved. And I wonder if that's not part of our puzzle. And I wanted to sort of throw, if possible, throw it that on top of the conversation.
The greatest reflection of the poisonous food that we have in our culture is how they have treated animals, how they have changed the diet that animals eat. You know, cows aren't meant to eat corn, and they're force-fed corn. And in order to deal with eating the corn with the diseases they get, they're shot out with antibiotics. And along with the antibiotics, they're shot up with hormones so that they can get a 200-and-something-pound or 400-pound cow in, you know, one-third of the time. That the shit that comes out of these cows is toxic, right? So you block the natural cycle of agriculture and of the earth. You know, the shit is supposed to be the substance of rebirth. And so if the whole alchemical process is dependent upon this shit, that is the fuel, that is the substance from which we transform our alchemical gold. Well, if you can't use the shit, then you can't do the alchemy. So then you're stuck. So this, you know, I don't know if this has begun in our food and it's manifesting in our society, or if this began in our society and it's manifesting in our food. But it doesn't matter which direction, because clearly it's going in both directions. My whole argument is that if you can find the synchro mystic universe in a Rihanna pop song, well, then your alchemical art will be a Rihanna pop song. It will be just as disposable and just as cartoonish and just as transient as a 3-minute pop song that's forgotten and spliced up and sampled less than a year later. But if you're using Finnegan's Wake as your beginning source, and if you really do crack that motherfucker, then maybe you will be producing alchemical gold or art on the level of Finnegan's Wake and James Joyce, something that might be misunderstood in 1939, but for Christ's sake, very smart people are still talking about it some 80 years later. I highly doubt that if a synchromystic community is around 80 years from now, that any time is going to be spent on a Rihanna video.
Doug, I know you love Rihanna. What do you think?
Should I throw a downer in there? What's going on?
You crossed the line, Bill. You crossed the line. You don't fuck with Doug's Rihanna.
I can't get under your umbrella.
Hello. So, what if... And understanding, so the artist was the demiurge who had to contain a whole universe, and then the genie came out of the bottle, so to speak, with our technology maybe, and now what we're doing is noticing the patterns on the cube and trying to put everything back together again. So the thing that I wonder about is what we do as a community, you know? And my dilemma oftentimes is, what is the value of seeing, like, pattern recognition with Rihanna videos and James Joyce and all this stuff, and then naturally we're compelled to record our findings and our data, you know, and then we're producing all these testimonials, fractal maps, I don't know what you want to call them, but all the blog research, that's the curiosity in me. Is that going to be some sort of, you know, interactive contextual doorway or portal to, you know,
are we creating the future Finnegan's Wake, or are we creating the future pop song? What does our work amount to?
Well, one blog post feels like a pop song, definitely. But then as you get, because it's all connected, it definitely has a more dense and web-like structure. And so, and I'm thinking that in all the fictions that handle sync, not specifically stated that way, as kind of the, and sync to me is a response, like a pop understanding of quantum physics, the interconnectedness of everything. If sync as like a zeitgeist, you know, the air, the flow, animating everything, is like the core of whatever the fictions at the time. Oh my goodness, I painted myself into a corner. So it seems like in the works that seem to speak to us as a community, oftentimes the characters end up in a story. You know, so we get the meta effect where we're reading the story, we're enjoying it, and then the characters realize that they're characters in a story. And so it feels like this is kind of what we're doing also, that we're characters in a story. But so what we're doing is writing the larger story. And my, you know, when I think about that, I wonder if the story we're writing isn't for some AI creature or aliens or, you know, something that human creatures aren't even going to enjoy, because what we're putting so much density, we're trying to capture every nuance of the silliness of reality and the, you know, the hamminess of the play. And so we're packing all this meaning and pattern into our blog posts, but they're all connected. And so you could, you know, like a spider dance on our webs and I don't know.
Well, that whole idea of the character recognizing the fiction that he is a character in, to me, has always resonated with, you can look out into the night sky and see the Milky Way, right? You can see the shape of it. But then to realize that you are actually in the thing that you're seeing, that's a tough one to really wrap your head around. It took me a long time to really kind of grok the concept that the way space, how big space is, and how, what the whole idea of space is that allows you to see the system that you're actually a part of. It's fucked up, right? So, because it's all a fractal, because we are the fractal, when we see the universe in a Rihanna pop song, and that's there, it's legitimate. I think that's 100% legitimate, and seeing the universe in that is the same as seeing the universe in Finnegan's Wake. But what if Rihanna's universe is just a micro spiral in a micro spiral of a small arm of a micro spiral of Finnegan's Wake? So it's
and
a ladder, right?
The
it's a ladder. You need to get that your hand on the first rung of the ladder. And so what this community is doing for everyone out there, and the thousands and thousands of people who read these blogs but have yet to have the courage or the foundation to comment or to become a part of it, they're seeing this and seeing this first rung of a ladder, and they're doing it themselves. And they're lifting themselves up, and then they're seeing the universe themselves in their own corner of culture. And maybe there's a movie from their past that they rewatch, and they realize how it connects to their father, or maybe there's part of it that they didn't realize connected to him because it's manifesting right now. But I'm saying that let's not forget that all of our culture, everything that's happening around us, is spiraling out of Finnegan's Wake. And let's not forget that everything that's happened in human history spiraled into the creation of Finnegan's Wake. There is a certain reverence and respect for density. You know, the fire
Bill, see, it was really interesting to me, like, hearing you say this, it's funny because I'm, if I may, it's like, I've argued the same thing about different big armed segments of the fractal, and hearing you say it, I'm sort of seeing the flaw in my own argument, which is actually pretty amazing.
Okay, hit me.
Is that, so, you know, my thing was, hey, we're noticing a fractal pattern, and that there are certain, what we might consider a big crest wave, and then here's the small ripple. So the Rihanna pop song is the ripple, and for you, it's Finnegan's Wake is the big crest. For me, it was other things, and I argue, like, ah, this is the really, like, check out this big wave here, how cool that is. But I'm thinking, it's like, ultimately, on a fractal, what you notice is that size doesn't matter. You know, it's like, because for when you go into the Rihanna pop song, you find that Rihanna pop song actually contains Finnegan's Wake. It's the same, it's the exact same structure. And then there's the idea, like, while you guys were talking, what I was thinking about was the movie Synecdoche, New York, if you've ever seen that.
Yeah.
And it's this idea of when Doug was saying we're creating this sort of model or this, you know, we're trying to encode everything. Well, what does he find is, I'm going to make a model of my universe, and then, wait a second, I have to be in my own model. So if I encode everything, then I'm in that. But then in that is a little me making a model of his universe. And within that is a little him making a, and so on, so on, so on. This is how we get this sort of, you know, two mirrors facing each other to infinity. Ultimately, if we want to place a value on a bigger fractal or something like that, does any fractal, whether it be a masterpiece like Finnegan's Wake or a piece of pop trash like a Rihanna song, no offense, Doug, however big or small the fractal is it still only a copy of the true majesty of this, you know, this reality, or is this reality
an argument that instead of it being a copy, it actually generates reality, so that we're the authors of the universe as we're, you know, that's the Inception illustration where you have the two arrows, which is the sync arrows, you know?
Yeah.
So we're writing the story as we're experiencing it, which speaks, it takes us right back into the heart of that conversation, which is what kind of reality are we generating? Is it a cheap plastic one, or is it like a nourishing, authentic one? And so how would, if you were going to write an interesting fiction that would actually, you know, that you would want to inhabit. Let's start there. Let's say, you know, you're going to create a universe. Would it be, you know, plastic and lurid or, you know, overly sexy? I don't know.
Well, you know, to go back to food and to poison, you know, we're living in a world now where cows shit out toxic shit that the earth doesn't know what to do with. It doesn't blend in, and it doesn't allow new life to grow. Okay, so
right. Cow shit itself used to be so sacred. Cow shit is where we get magic mushrooms, and was, according to McKenna, you know, cows are the earliest form of religion and cults because of their sacred shit.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, maybe there is a fraction of usable shit in that toxic pile, but you'd have to go through some chemical process to extract the shit to do an alchemical process, right? So we live in a chemical society that depends on chemicals. Everything in our life is a ping pong match of chemicals. You get up and you choose the chemical you need to get through the part of the day to get some part of the fractal that is busted. It just seems clear to anyone who's lived life in this country for the last, 40 years. I think that's why there's so much concern. And so maybe when you have a Rihanna pop song, you're redeeming the pop song. You're putting your own lens on it to extract the sliver. Like, a pop song should just be pure. It should just speak for itself.
Well, what if we're the grouchy old men sitting on the porch saying, in my day, a pop song was a pop song?
Let me ask you this. What was the number one song from the year 2003?
This is the problem with this, is that there was an article I read, I think, in the New Yorker, where the guy says our time, it lacks a distinct flavor. We don't have an age anymore where there's a fashion, so like there isn't a zeitgeist anymore. It's everything happening all at the same time because we have all this recorded information, like the 60s, there's a flavor, you can tell you're in the 60s because of this, this, and this, and this. Same with the 70s, say what you want about the 70s, but you can see, now we're in our time. So can we understand our time? I don't know, but as far as like what's the music of our time, what's the quality of our age, it seems like everyone's free to go back in time and do whatever they want. And as far as like really being able to put your finger on like a movement or anything, it's harder to do that now that we have
end up like the characters in the Eagles song Life in the Fast Lane, right? Everything all the time, and then that just leads to a complete burnout and crash. Are we becoming the magicians that can handle everything all the time? Are we going to be Dr. Manhattan, or are we going to be the burnt out crack whore at the end of Life in the Fast Lane?
We're out of the arms of the fractals, and we're into the arms of Cthulhu, right? With the multi-armed alien beast. But the salvation is that the fractal is in Cthulhu, because that's where you could say there isn't, differing directions. Anyone who saves themselves has to be like Danny in The Shining. You have to retrace your steps. You've been running away from something for so long that in order to realize that you've actually escaped the thing, you need to take a few steps backwards. And, I do notice that whole thing. I have a car from, 2002. It's 10 years later. That car should stick out on the street. If it was 1995 and I had a car from 1985, I would be a little embarrassed to be driving a car from 1985. That doesn't happen right now. And I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, but it definitely sticks out.
Okay,
but it puts out to me because I can remember it. I was, we are living on the cusp of something, a transition, where we can understand that. We can understand the absurdity of why when I went to grade school, if someone wore bell bottoms, they were laughed at, but if they wore them in high school, they were hip all of a sudden.
Is this the left brain's world where all of a sudden with cars, it seems like the functionality has trumped all the aesthetics. So, there's a little aesthetic tweaking in a new release of a car, but for all intents and purposes, they're like wind tunneling everything, and so you end up with a similar shape on everything. Or we just, because we're in it, we can't see the differences, and then 10 years from now, the differences will be really apparent. It's just we can't see. I don't know. But I hear exactly what you're saying. For the last 20 years or so, everything has been, somewhere towards the end of the 90s, the music's roughly the same, and everything's kind of...
I have no fashion sense whatsoever. I wear
slacks and a golf shirt, slacks and a t-shirt. I've worn that for 20 years. I haven't fucking changed. That's a little bizarre, or it's seemingly that sort of pattern should be bizarre to me, but it's not. It blends for some reason, or at least I'm led to believe it blends. Just because it's ubiquitous. I see it all around me. It doesn't seem like if someone in 1955 was wearing the clothes they wore in high school in 1975, it would just, it wouldn't happen, or it shouldn't happen. But it definitely seems to be a symptom of something. And so if we're seeing the universe in a Rihanna song, it should stick out, right? It should. The fact that we can deconstruct a Rihanna song and apply it, maybe it's a better thing than I'm giving it credit for. You know, maybe I'm jumping on it out of just a rejection of it, out of fear or something. But it's something to be looked at. It's something to be studied. And so I'm not saying that putting time into it is worthless. I'm not at all. But it shouldn't be, like anything, a path of closure. Like, you know, obviously, it's not anything, it's not like that to you. I'm not saying that, but I don't know. It's all shit.
Yeah, I mean, so I had a really funny think this weekend was that after doing a, you know, we were talking for the last 3 weeks about the nuclear test at Bikini Atoll, and we were comparing the bikini with the splitting of the atom and all these different things, and we're just like, bikini, bikini, bikini. Well, my sister-in-law came to New York this weekend. She designed a bunch of bikinis, and she invites me and my wife to her fashion show she had. So we spent a few hours on, I think it was Saturday night, at this bikini fashion show, just hours and hours of girls in bikinis, and we're like, and suddenly I'm like, my wife and I were having a terrible time. They're just blasting Rihanna over and over and over and over again, the same like three songs for like 3 hours. And, you know, girls in bikinis, that's nice to a point where like they all kind of looked the same, you know, the bikinis and the models. And it's like, okay, I just feel like I'm kind of stuck in a loop here. And it was only like, so like, I was like, what the fuck are we doing here? And then it hits me. We've been thinking with bikinis, and I'm like, oh shit. Like it was like, you know, at one moment it was like this awesome thing when I realized how it tied into everything else is that I had sort of, you know, a weird sort of way we had manifested the very topic we're talking about. So now if it's, hey, this power is within us to manifest, that's great. If that's, of course, if that's the phenomenon we're experiencing, or is it just, you know, something else. I come from the idea that, yes, it's like that, you know, Doug's inception cycle is like we're partly creating and creating by, so we're inspired by one thing and now we've sort of manifested something else. So I come at it from that perspective, but of course that could be argued one way or the other. But in that moment of realizing, oh, this is just a reflection of the thoughts in my head, whether or not I manifested that or it's just as simple as it's a reflection, how awesome is that? For a moment, it became something very cool. And yet, you know, a few minutes later, the same Rihanna song starts again, and I'm like, well, I'm done. You know, like, can we go home? So after hearing hours of Rihanna, I mean, I don't really think there is much there. It actually sucks because I think the woman has an amazing voice. That's the sort of shame of it, but I really find, is it the repetition, what is it that I personally find distasteful? The reason I thought this was a great segue is like the idea that you're finding wonder in a plastic toy puzzle, and I'm just sort of want to throw that back out there is like, do we make a distinction of the pop song and the plastic toy?
Well, I'll say this. If you've seen that movie Prometheus, there's a character who Holloway, he's one of the main characters. And when he's on the deck of the ship and they're getting their briefing on why they're there or what their goal is, he's twirling something in his hand. And it's clearly a Rubik's Cube, but not some plastic Rubik's Cube. It's some made out of some pristine metal, you know, maybe titanium or something like that. But it's just an interesting little fragment to invade the scene of a movie. I mean, it was clearly a prop that was constructed and made specifically to make an appearance in just the random action of a character. You know, it's not in focus. It's part of the scenery, but it's there. Ridley Scott put it there. Why did he put it there? Why is it part of the fabric of that film? Well, you know, that's up for anyone out there to decide for themselves. What I'm saying, though, is that the formula that it takes to construct a Rubik's Cube is a formula that is that has more history, that has more ability to engrave itself upon the structure of your mind than clearly the formulaic methods with which they construct the songs that they choose Rihanna to sing. You know, there's a bunch of different producers and songwriters and musicians who are working much like the factories did for the Monkees, and they're combining sounds and they're combining rhythms and they're remixing and they're doing all this stuff. And when they have something that rises to the surface that really, you know, they think is going to be a hit, they decide who's going to get it. And because Rihanna has, you know, the marketability and she has the it factor, they give it to her, and she puts her voice into it, and then you make money. You know, it's an art.
There's money in her voice. Her voice is full of money. That's 42 minutes, guys. That's it. So, I don't know. I screwed up last week and let David, or I didn't put the time, the official 42-minute time clock on, and so we went 46 minutes. But, you know, I think we should continue into the green room for a little bit. So that's it. Next week, Alan's hosting with – I'm on vacation. Will's on vacation. Everyone
next,
take
next week will be Frater X.
Excellent. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Be well. Take care. Thank you, Bill. It was great. Let's continue. All right.